Okay, so tonight we have the Sambodhi Sutta, the Wings to Self-Awakening. But first, I would like to have Matt read our Crossroads Meditation Center and Common Buddha purpose statement.
I'm going to check on Zoom, see if anyone's on.
Good, I think. Or I don't even know that. Participants? Phil, Joan, Jane, Mary, Tracy. Yeah, we're good.
Oh, you gotta admit them. From right.
Over here.
Nope, up top, upper right. Admit all. Coming Buddha Crossover Meditation Center preserves and presents a human Buddha's Dhamma, initially recorded as the second book of the Pali Canon, the Sutta. Our practice is informed from over 300 curated suttas restored by John to their original intent and practical focus. Our practice is empty of imagined insight, magical thinking, mystical grasping after, and unfounded speculation. Our teachers and students remain focused on these suttas to develop a direct, mindful experience of establishing a well-concentrated, supple, and conflict-free mind through the Eightfold Path. It is the Eightfold Path that Siddhartha Gautama taught over the last 45 years of his life with the sole purpose of abandoning self-inflicted stress and suffering through ending ignorance of four noble truths. That's kind of nice. Pathimoksha means towards liberation. These guidelines support a well-informed and well-focused Sangha and establish the most effective environment for Dhamma practice, always focused on liberation from ignorance. Coming Buddha Crossroads Meditation Center is a true refuge from the chaos of the world, and ideological contradictions, and foundational confusion prevalent in modern Buddhism by common agreement. Our practice is framed by the Eightfold Path, which establishes a skillful balance of jhana meditation, sutta study, sangha participation, and daily individual dhamma practice. When gathered for dhamma class, we refer only to the Buddha's dhamma as restored by jhana, presented by our teachers. When gathered as a sangha, we accept responsibility for maintaining the gentle integrity of our sangha. When gathered as a sangha, we are free of grasping after magical, mystical, and speculative concepts and fabricated experiences. When gathered as a sangha, we practice wise restraint. Questions or confusion about verbiage arising from comparisons to other modern Buddhist practices, modern Buddhist teachers, or what they are teaching are not a part of our Dhamma classes or our sangha discussions and should be addressed directly to our teachers outside of Dhamma class. Individual class suttas are linked in our newsletter for home study prior to class.
Thank you, Matt. All right, so back to our structured study. I think it's useful to frame this sutta a little bit. It is pretty vast, the breadth of it. There's a lot that's referenced here, but where we are in our structured study is the Eightfold Path. We've begun to develop some understanding and right view and right intention, which are the wisdom factor. And now we're talking about the virtuous factors. We've been building on that the last few classes with right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And this sutta sort of emphasizes that as well. So I'll read through and we can go from there. All right, so I'll introduce this sutta with some of John's words. The Sambodhi Sutta, the wings of self-awakening. The Buddha here teaches qualities to be developed that provide the wings to self-awakening. As seen here, it is through an authentic Dhamma practice framed by the Eightfold Path and the support of a well-informed Sangha that provides the guidance necessary for developing insight into impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and the stress and suffering that follows from a lack of understanding of Four Noble Truths. So I think it's also, I'm going to share a little bit, you know, sitting in this seat at this point's a little bit of time for me, and you know, just maybe to set sort of the tone for this sutta. Matt did a good job in the mission statement about Patti Moksha, which is instruction for monastics and Dhamma practice. And that's not what we are here. We're householders. So let's consider that in this sutta as well. And also the words of our teacher, John. The last time he sat here, he spoke of the importance of wise associations, if you recall. It was his final teaching that he gave here. And it's an auspicious time to revisit that, because it really is, as the sutta said, the wings to self-awakening. When we're struggling with Dhamma practice, when we have attachments in the world, when we're caught up in other things, associations, as we mentioned earlier, pieces of our identity that are found through our livelihood, through our families, etc., out in the world. It's important to have a well-focused sangha. And like we said, it's a gentle reminder, a gentle place that we can take refuge from what's going on in the world, what we're subject to. Impermanence and the resulting stress of not understanding who we are in the moment. In other words, anatta. We've heard a lot of different ways to describe that. We're not going to do that tonight. The sutta will refer to five clinging aggregates, but we're not going to really get into that tonight. We don't need to. We did that in the Eightfold Path. But we're going to focus on how associations maintain our integrity in the world and our virtue, how we're virtuous around our associations, and what we need to do practicing restraint in order to really take a look at our associations, who's in our life. You know, when we practice the Dhamma, other Sangha members who've been here or not here have said, start to notice people maybe aren't there as much, or you're not interacting with those people. Your life is centered on awakening, and the best way to do that is to practice and practice with others as we do here. So that was my little introduction. We got to take off and get some wings now, right? All right, Sambodhi Sutta.
Somebody wrote wings.
No buffalo wings, Buddha wings here. The Angara. Sorry, John. Anguttara Nikaya Sutta. The Buddha was at Anapatika's monastery at Jita's Grove. He asked those gathered, "Friends, if other sects were to ask you what are the prerequisites for developing the wings of self-awakening, how would you respond?" The monks and nuns asked the Buddha to tell them this response so that they would remember it clearly. The Buddha's words, "Listen closely then. The prerequisites for developing the wings to self-awakening are here for you and available to everyone through the Dhamma." The Buddha continues, "When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected that they will be virtuous and restrained in seeing the danger in the slightest faults. When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected that they will hear sober talk and talks conducive to gaining understanding. They will hear talks on modesty, contentment, the value of seclusion and quiet, non-entanglement, persistence, virtue, concentration, discernment, and the knowledge of true vision and release from craving and clinging." Sounds a lot like the Eightfold Path. "When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected that they will maintain discernment and understanding of impermanence and the cessation of stress. Once these qualities are developed, there are four more to develop." Let's not obsess about the list here. Let's just let this go through. "Contemplation of what is unattractive so as to abandon craving. Goodwill should be developed so as to abandon ill will. Mindfulness of the breath in the body should be developed so as to develop non-distraction. They should develop understanding of impermanence so as to uproot conceit and end further eye-making." Just for 1 second, let's stop. So that sounds an awful lot like what we're saying. We're gaining wisdom. We've used the word right and wrong, skillful, unskillful, wise and unwise. That's what we're starting to talk about here. We start to know the difference now. We know what leads to stress and suffering. and basically through birth, through craving and clinging and attachments in the world, right? The Buddha continues, "For when one understands impermanence, clinging to anatta, to not self, is abandoned. Understanding not self uproots conceit. The binding arises in the moment." I'll continue. Buddha. "And when one has seen the five clinging aggregates as they really are, the arising and the passing away, understanding the attraction and distraction, seeing the arising of desire and the continued delusion, and being delivered from the five clinging aggregates, this one is released from clinging. All defilements are destroyed. What must be done has been done. Perfection is attained. The burden has been put down. The highest goal attained. And this one is liberated by perfect insight." That's the end of the sutta. So, let's if anybody has anything specific to the sutta, if there's confusion, if anybody would like to ask about that before we get into sharing our current practice and maybe where this could fit in. Anybody? Laura?
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about this connection between conceit and impermanence?
Mm-hmm.
And I know as you were reading the Buddha's words, it said that the connection there is, you know, clinging to anatta or a non-self, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. this idea that a permanent self exists or,
mm-hmm.
you know, but, you know, that conceit, can you talk about that connection a little bit
Might
more?
Might be able to.
Yeah.
Hmm. All right. So how would we understand conceit in the present moment, then, is sort of what you're asking? I mean,
yeah, I know it's never justified, obviously, but mm-hmm. sometimes I struggle with that word, like mm-hmm. being like a
yeah.
direct connection to anatta and impermanence. And...
Right. Well, we can use a reference from another sutta, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, to uproot conceit in the present moment.
Mm.
I was going to ask that question to you or to somebody, but I'll answer it. The way we would do that in the present moment is to refer back to something like that, where we understand that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am, this is not myself. We're personalizing a phenomenon in the world. We're attaching to something that's arising and passing away, instead of letting it arise and pass away on its own. Another way that you could orient yourself, as the Buddha says here, through perfect insight, would be to maintain or recollect the fourth foundation of mindfulness, to notice the quality of your mind in a situation. Are you anxious? Are you upset about something that's happening? Are you really, you know, looking to involve yourself when restraint could be applied there, right? I know it's difficult in the world. This is bringing into associations, like we said, livelihoods are a different scenario. But with continued practice, you're going to be able to be out in the world. And we've talked about this as a friction. You're going to see less friction. You still have to experience dukkha in the world, relatively, by association. This is probably where you're going to experience it the most. In professional settings and familial settings, we do have to sometimes maintain physical proximity to those that we may find stressful.
Mm-hmm.
What we can do there is to maintain a sense of calm in our mind by practicing four foundations of mindfulness. Maybe, as we just referred to the last couple of weeks, when the opportunity to say something arises, we may find ourselves not speaking.
Right.
We're still in the world, but out of our speech is where you may find conceit really, you know, being identifiable.
Right.
So I don't know if that was a complete answer to your question, but it might have been a little insight. Maybe Matt would like to, if you want to share a little.
I think, you know, in relation to impermanence, conceit is impermanent.
Mm.
There's conceit.
Yeah.
And then it's gone. And then there it is again. And then it's gone. So we accept that conceit arises and passes away in the mind. Conceit arises and passes away in speech. And when you recognize that you are caught up in conceit in your mind or in your speech, recognize that there's conceit.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's gone, recognize that it's not there anymore. Now, this isn't about not feeling things. Things occur. We are sensitive and conscious beings,
mm-hmm.
as John would say. So we're going to experience unskillful qualities of mind. And that's not the end of our practice. It's the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
If I may, the word conceit itself is a little bit old-fashioned,
mm-hmm.
but it's two things. It has a specific meaning now, and I believe the Buddha used the word conceit as a shorthand to describe the presence of this non-self, this kind of overwhelming, you know,
right.
attention-grabbing part of this construct that we have. And if you look at how it manifests itself, and you look at the actual meaning of conceit, yeah, absolutely, it is conceit. You know, it is an overemphasis on the value of this thing here,
right.
that we made,
mm-hmm.
and he. Yeah, he directly calls it conceit because, you know, recognize it for what it is. And once you can recognize it, you have an opportunity to leave it behind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Would anybody like to share about how associations are coming up in their practice or where in their life they see associations, whether they're physical or not, where they've maybe been able to identify some craving there at all? Would anybody like to share? I'll share. Yeah, you know, I mean, I deal with this a lot. I've, many of you may know, I participate in golf. I've done it for most of my life, 35, 40 years, I guess, now. So I often have associations that are internal or external. External would be who I'm playing with, who I'm associating with, members of clubs, etc. And then internal, there's this association. Well, you know, I mean, I like to be a member of that club, or what do I have to do that? And I find it a lot, or I have felt it in the past. But probably since I started taking up on this practice, that stuff just goes away, and I have a great time out there. I've been very blessed, and people still call me. I guess they still like hanging out with me out there, and I'm not on any bad list. So, you know, the important places let me in, and I don't have to be a member of these places to enjoy it. I'm enjoying my life. I'm enjoying the experience for what it is. And
you get paid.
And and I'm talking about the actual leisure part. And then at the end, where I can just say, you know, I might have played a top 50 golf course in the country today, but it's just a nice walk around the golf course. At the end, it was very nice, and I would sure love to play it again, but I'm not going to sit there and obsess that I got to get back there. It'll happen when I get back there. I'll get the call back, probably because I shot a good round. But no, but it's simple as that. I mean, it's being honest enough with myself to say, am I content? Do I need to keep pushing, grinding, and have to meet 10 more people of a certain group to get back to this place? No, I don't do that anymore. I used to, and I, frankly, everybody I encounter is that way. I don't really like these people who chase these experiences because they missed it. if you're talking about the next time, I want to hear about the time you were there. You know, let's talk about that. Let's talk about your experience, not your fabrication, right? So it's not really that cohesive, but I go through it all the time, and I let it go. I let it go. It's nice to have good friends and their wise associations, right? I don't have to cling and crave and obsess on how to make it at a top golf course. I'm already in. I already have friends that take care of me. I have wise associations, and that's it. And I continue with my practice and continue knocking the ball down the middle of the fairway. So that's an internal association. Again, it's a little abstract, but I think it might be helpful here. You know, Laura, you were kind of hitting on it professionally. There could be some internal association. We run into this with the world at large, given our age, our family setting, our family position. You're supposed to be a certain way or in a certain place, perhaps. It's all fabrication. You're supposed to be here. And for all of you, you're here. So you're showing up. This is a wise association. I don't know if that was helpful or not, but Tim, yes.
It's a tightrope because there's this identifying factor involved sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting we should do that now with this discussion, but like
mm-hmm.
one thing I would ask myself is, well, why?
Right.
Walking down this golf course.
And right.
Maybe that's an unscoped question. Internal.
Right. Well, you did a really good job sharing this earlier. Why were you continuing in your hobby? I don't want to put you on the spot. Well, you did a great job of explaining this earlier. If you wanted to continue to share, it might be helpful. You know, your hobby of photography, and you found you were reasons, right?
Yeah, there was identifying and craving not acceptance, but praise.
Right.
And then especially with your peers in a particular group, whether it be the golf course,
mm-hmm.
the club, or
the photography group, right.
And there's also, when we talk about wise associations, you know, I found myself surrounded by not so wise associations because maybe they would say to you, oh, this is really nice, but that's not really what they think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
so that's when I asked the question, but why am I doing this?
Right.
And I think it's a tightrope because mm-hmm. to do something because of the quality and the peacefulness aspect of it, that almost like flow
mm-hmm.
where you live in the present moment. You're in the present moment. Whether it, you know, the golf course or
mm-hmm.
the top photographs or whatever, then that's skillful. And if there are people around you that can be part of that, mm-hmm. then that's a wise association.
Mm-hmm.
I find that with these experiences, that awareness is something that I'm more receptive to.
Mm-hmm. Very good. The right intention of craving and clinging. Am I doing this for something other than just doing it, right? Is there something behind doing this? Am I trying to make photographs that get published or beat the guy next year, have a better camera? What, you can make up anything.
That's right? feeding
PC. Yeah.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
So those are the awareness factors that I've developed through the Dhamma.
Mm-hmm.
It's a work in progress. I could really talk about it all mm-hmm. the struggles. That awareness gets developed where it's almost like there's like a conversation going on your shoulders
mm-hmm.
in real time. And I think that's when there's this identifying egotistical
mm-hmm.
conceit.
Right.
And everything's impermanent. So to your point, it's really no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's when, you know, I know that this is an unskillful.
Right. This is not that easy to see. It really isn't. It takes time. It takes honesty. You know, it takes a well-informed sangha, a place to talk about this, right? So this is, we're saying, you know, when the wind's blowing, this is what helps get the air under our wings a little, by showing up here, having people ask these types of thoughtful questions, and, you know, showing us the fruits of their practice.
Yeah, would you read that section on sober talks again?
I will. This is a good one to sort of continue with what we were talking about, right speech, etc., wise restraint. This is the second section. When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected that they will hear sober talk and talks conducive to gaining understanding. They will hear talks on modesty, contentment, the value of seclusion, quiet, non-entanglement, persistence, virtue, concentration, discernment, and the knowledge of true vision and release from craving and clinging. And yes, I mean, I think that is very applicable here. You know, we've just been talking about what we're trying to do, narrow our focus into the Dhamma, use the guideposts of the Dhamma, the Eightfold Path, to practice wisdom, virtue, and concentration. That's what we're trying to do. And naturally, that will start to, you know, be in our life. You know, we'll start to have that. We'll start to have perfect insight. And insight, you know, I'd even ask that question. What is he talking about? Perfect insight. What do you think that is? Anybody want to? Michael?
Recognizing the ego self in the present moment.
Yes, very close. What would be another word for it? Would be right view. Right view. Yeah. And how can we describe right view?
Right view.
You know,
it's the application. Right view informs the rest of the Eightfold Path.
Right, right. And what it is understanding stress, abandoning the origination of stress, experiencing the cessation of stress, and practicing Noble Eightfold Path.
What is the cause of stress? The cause of stress is identification with the ego self in the present moment. That's the cause of stress itself.
That is very good. That is conceit, right?
Yes.
That's what you just described.
Yes.
Michael just described conceit.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the best that we've heard tonight. Very good.
But it's not the only. Because if you don't have impermanence in there as well, you're missing a section.
Mm-hmm.
So to describe right view only as understanding anatta is not right view.
Well, I have to think that I'm not identifying with the ego self. Understanding the three marks of existence or be subject to the three marks of existence, I would understand them that three marks of existence is also of the not self.
Understanding the not self is understanding the not self. Understanding that if that is the only understanding, you're missing two thirds of the Dhamma.
Wouldn't the awareness be enough?
Well,
than the understanding?
Is that it?
The awareness of it?
I would put those two together. That's at that point you're being probably a little bit semantic about. But the first noble truth is described as understanding stress. And stress is not just caused by the overwhelming presence of this not-self thing that we've constructed. It also is caused by not understanding or not acknowledging impermanence, including the impermanence of the not-self, including the impermanence of understanding the not-self.
Which is why the Buddha said, be mindful of impermanence to end conceit.
Yeah. Yes.
We were, but it was very, I like that.
These things are solidly intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
And need to be integrated.
It isn't like the ego, the reason for the ego self is to make permanence, make a permanent self.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
don't understand impermanence, mm-hmm. Your understanding of the not self is already halfway down the tubes. Mm-hmm. This is a subtle thing, because as you're moving, as you're understanding, as your travel down the Eightfold Path continues, there will be moments of, there'll be these aha moments. And it's not like there is a final aha moment. There is, the trouble with aha moments is that they are a signpost only. They are not the goalpost.
What is the root? What is the root? Of ignorance.
The root of ignorance?
Yes.
Well, that's why it's a good thing that, mm-hmm. that we have this space here, mm-hmm. to hear sober talks.
Mm-hmm.
And among wise associations, and when we hear sober talks, and we hear talks about modesty and talks about
seclusion
and all these things, this is orienting our minds back towards the Eightfold Path, back towards the practice of restraint in life, back towards using the Eightfold Path as a framework for our lives. So we go back to right view. We go back to right intention. We go back to right speech, right action, right livelihood. We go back to right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. And we just keep coming back to that. And when we keep training our attention to return back to the Eightfold Path, those kinds of things are, we gain insight into them, into the root of ignorance, into the root of stress, the understanding of stress, the understanding of our contribution to stress. So those are the wings of self-awakening. The Buddha doesn't awaken you. You awaken you.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So this wings of self-awakening, how are they granted? By your own effort. That's why the Buddha was rightly self-awakened for.
And you're kept aloft with what we're talking about, hearing sober talks, revisiting the Eightfold Path, you know, having wise associations, all of those things, you know, keeping talks on what proper insight is, right? Or you know, discernment, instead of what else we could be doing, right?
Well, the root, I interpret the root of ignorance as the self-reference.
Who does? Who was it that did that?
Mm-hmm.
Who was it?
Who was it and what?
That determined that the root is
I that's the way I understand.
I.
What?
The R.
Ah.
This is
it's
where
recognizing
this is where the second
the
layer. This is where the
moment.
Second layer of conceit comes in. That's where I'm trying to warn you against. I grant, I don't grant things. your understanding of not self is quite deep. However, it's only part of the Dharma. It's not the complete Dharma. It is not the goal. It is not the one base. It is part of it. So I would urge you to see that insight that you have in the full context of the Dharma.
I'm going to investigate this, as I always do.
Right. I mean, I like what Ram said there. You know, part of the sutta does talk about uprooting conceit, uprooting eye-making, etc., which is what you're talking about. However, I do believe Ram, you know, is trying to illuminate the larger whole what's holding that view, you know, and that's the entire Dhamma, the Eightfold Path. You know, self-referential views are a very important and insightful piece to recognize and abandon. And to notice when they are present and to abandon them, abandon unskillful qualities, right? You know, it sort of comes back to, you know, the questions that we're asking, you know, the root of all this is ignorance, you know, the root of everything is ignorance. And we continually come up against that. And that's why, like what we're saying, we have a well-informed Sangha to keep support.
The root of all things is ignorance, right?
Well, I don't want to go that far down there, but in the root of suffering, you could possibly say is ignorance, but I would even be a little held on saying that, but you could.
Well, when the Buddha says, what is ignorance?
What is ignorance? It's self-identification.
No. That's
not what he says. He says, ignorance is not understanding the four noble truths. That's the literal thing that he says. So it relates to all four noble truths. And it's a whole. It is not a singular thing. That's why I have to keep coming back to this, because if you relate ignorance only to self, then you are not having a full understanding of ignorance.
The understanding I have is mm-hmm. to the selfness. I look at the Eightfold Path as being, from right view, is a selfless endeavor. So all things that emanate from the Eightfold Path, to practice the Eightfold Path, you have to be selfless. There is no self-reference in the Eightfold Path. It's the same as compassion. Mm-hmm. There's no self-reference with compassion.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I understand it. That right. Non-self reference with the ego self is the abandonment of the ego self as it arises each and every moment. Freeing us
that may
from
be.
That which binds us, which is ignorance and identification with the ego self.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine.
That is Mike Murphy's understanding.
Right, and that's fine.
And you have your own.
That's fine. That's fine theoretically, but it's. We have to come back to the actual practice mm-hmm. of this, which is we can't, like you had said,
to practice the Eightfold Path, you have to be selfless. No.
Yeah.
No, you have to, yeah, you start where you are. You start where you are.
Because, right, you, I mean, Matt and Kevin, isn't failure a part of that path? And not overcoming, but that's just going to happen, but you get back on the path.
Right.
You know, it's like John always said, you veer off it, then you go back on. I get what Michael's saying about the selflessness being, you know, a very big component, but it doesn't preclude you from, you know, that process of like being off the path and then getting back on. People online have
I apologize, I forgot you there. I want to go around the room here, but no, I mean, yeah, that's like you just said, that's what the wings of self-awakening, like what's going to keep your practice aloft, what's going to keep you coming back, a sangha that provides these things, that what we're doing right here, having a sober talk that's conducive to understanding, this is what this is mentioning here. So yes, the sangha is, you know, there's a lot of emphasis placed on it, and this is very illustrative of why. Because we do fall off the path, we do experience dukkha in the world. The best place to probably go and find your calm again is where people are doing that. You know, you can go to the Thursday night bowling league, you can do what you want, but this is where the rubber is going to meet the road. These are the people that are doing it, you know. And you online, sorry. All right, let's go. And what do we have to say about wise associations? And if you'd like to share about that, if you'd like to share about anything in the sutta,
sure, I'll go.
Tracy,
yeah. I had a couple thoughts about wise associations. And more so a question. So if we're in right view during our day and in our life, can any association be a wise association if you're not attaching and practicing the Dhamma? That's the question.
Remember impermanence to understand conceit.
Can you explain your answer? I'm not really sure. I'm not connecting the two.
Well, how could I be in something all day long? I could, you know, I'm not even in my clothes all day long.
No, I just mean like, okay, we're in our lives. We leave the sangha, we go back to our lives, we have our jobs, we have our relationships, we have this, we have that. My question is, can any of those things, those different domains of relationships, be wise associations if we are maintaining right view through those interactions?
Yes. I mean, you can, in your relationship with your partner, there is opportunity to enter and remain in right view. In your relationship with your coworker, there is opportunity to enter and remain in right view.
Are we not responsible for other people's?
Yes,
we're not responsible for anyone else's behavior. But is there an opportunity to enter and remain in right
view? So what that would look like, perhaps?
Wise associations.
It would be an association. The wisdom is applied. Can anybody think of where it would be applied? If you have an association that it is an association, period. Okay.
Right.
It's an association. It's an association. So how would we apply our growing understanding, aka wisdom, in that situation? Does anybody want to answer this?
Well, yeah, I think
what's it gonna sound like? It's gonna sound like nothing. It's gonna be noble silence. Mm-hmm. It's gonna be right speech. That's where it comes out. That's where we interact with the world. So we are in association, and we are the ones responsible for how wow. how we're gonna def- yeah, yeah right we bring it in, we bring it there. It's not them, because I don't know these guys. I don't know Dave, or I don't know Judy, or I don't know they don't do this stuff, so they're not the ones that are going to bring it. So we as Dhamma practitioners do that when we're in the world.
But not all associations are wise associations. If I walk into a correct. Bar and I'm a guru.
You don't say anything. You know, you don't start.
And everyone else is drinking. Yes, I can use my wise restraint right. and all that. But do I belong there? No, I don't.
Right.
It's not,
right.
These people are not wise associations.
Correct. Correct.
Because yeah. they're not following
correct.
Practice. They're not practicing. Yeah, exactly.
However, when your car breaks down and you have to go into the bar to ask to use the telephone,
right. That's okay, but
you have to be.
Tracy was asking
right?
if they would be.
You may not get the whiskey, but you need the telephone.
Tracy was saying if we were in right view, if these other associations would be right wise associations, no, they would not. They would still be right. unwise associations, but we would still be in right view, and it wouldn't matter. We're not gonna cause stress and suffering in their lives, but are they wise associations?
The wise associations. Let's not get tricked on yeah. wise. The Buddha is the one placing that. Because he knows that you know what, at least he thinks you know what unwise is.
Right, exactly.
He could have just said associations. We could do the same talk and take out the word wise. It would mean the same thing. It really would. I don't want to go that far. But the point is, associations are associations, right?
Wasn't the point, though, of when the Buddha was explaining to the Sangha, the idea of wise associations was this ability of the not self and the ego to rationalize anything. And so by submitting yourself in the presence of unwise associations, there is a temptation or a chance that it could knock you off the rails.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, exactly. To use Julia's example, if you're hanging out in bar bowling every night, you're probably not going to dumb, you know, right. You're not going to be here on Tuesday. You're going to be drinking. So,
but it's a good thing. What it comes down to is, he's talking about the association that you choose,
right,
to be in.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
That's where it's not, because in the association that you don't choose to be in, it is your own wisdom. That makes it a wise association.
Exactly right.
And it goes only as far as your skin.
Mm-hmm.
In associations that he was talking to about in the Sambodhi Sutta, mm-hmm. it is those associations that you choose.
Right? Yes.
Right. But
okay, that makes more sense to me, because
yeah,
the question, I, you know, sort of the way that I was looking at it and asking the question is, even if you find, if you're in right view, starting with that, even if you're in the presence of a group of people or a person who is clearly not a wise association, I was thinking of it in the sense of like, doesn't that, if you're in right view, that then witnessing this experience of this other person could actually inform your deeper understanding of the Four Noble Truths and seeing their clinging and craving and seeing the suffering that they're experiencing and recognizing and reinforcing what we're learning here. Mm-hmm. But I see now, Julia, you had said that in this sutta in particular, he was talking about your choosing to be in different things. I was thinking of it more so just like, you know, so you can't always get the opportunity to, you know, choose who you're having a meeting with, or
mm-hmm.
the way your spouse is reacting to something that you see as an impermanent thing that isn't, you know, mm-hmm. but that makes more sense then.
Yeah. That's useful insight. Since I'm sitting in the front, I'm going to say this. I followed everything. I do agree with Matt a little bit that when in right view, I think that you could simply say when in the world. The world, and thus, you know, then you apply four foundations of mindfulness, notice the quality of your mind, notice the feelings, the thoughts, the breathing. Now, maybe we're able to apply right view. So there is a little bit of a thing there. I mean, I'm not trying to, I just think saying in being in right view, I don't know if
you notice the you notice.
I don't know if that is you're in the world, but you're seeing things more clearly because you're gaining understanding. You, Tracy, you have been practicing. You are, your wisdom is supplanting where there was ignorance. But to be in right view is, oh, maybe I'm the one messing up on words. I apologize.
You notice the illusion of wrong view.
And enter and remain in right view. Yeah, exactly. That's right. So I think that kind of goes to what Matt was saying. It's in a state of flux. It's that's the only thing that I, and you know, it's like, don't just set out, I'm going for a day, I'm in right view, I'm in a week of right view. It's you know, someone you have to pay your taxes or whatever else happens. I mean, yeah, you might be out of right view for a minute or two, but you know, so
that's still what you, even though you're in right view.
But Tracy, very good insight. I that was very useful. Thank you for sharing.
Thanks to you for letting me share. And thanks for the teaching.
So let's continue around on the internet online here. Is there anybody else that would like to maybe talk about the Eightfold Path, Wise Associations, and how?
Certainly.
Jane.
I would love to do that. Thank you for the teaching. First of all, I want to say that my practice would not be as developed as it is without the support of the Sangha. I mean, the insights that are gained through class and, you know, these discussions, it's invaluable. Secondly, I had picked out two sentences before class, and they seem appropriate. It says, many times we have no choice who we are with, but being in physical proximity does not necessarily bring association, which is true. Which is true. And the other one was, as we develop understanding of our own motivations and reactions, we gain understanding of others' motivations and reactions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it boils down to that and what Matt said about, you know, the practice. It's using the Eightfold Path as a framework for our lives. So I just don't think it goes any further than that.
Yeah, thank you, Jane. Those are really useful words. Those are John's words at the beginning of the sutta that I also did zero in on, and we were talking about that today, sort of the associations that, how insidious they can be. Really good insight, Jane. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? Raquel?
Yes, I would like to, I know what Tracy, I had the same question as Tracy, and because, for instance, and a good example for me is like at work, being with the right association, being with the right people that think alike. For instance, with the practice of the Buddha, I think I can only do this when I'm at the Sangha. I mean, being with the right association, but I think not being with the right people gives you an opportunity to practice the right view. And I think it's easier to be in the settings like we think alike here. But I think the challenge and the learnings that you do when you are with the people that are not, seems to be not the right association. And also, we need to be kind, right? We need to others.
Right. What's another word for all of those things you described? What can you practice in the world when you're with associations, in quote, what can you practice? You don't have to.
Right.
Not what I was thinking. Come on, Laura. You know what this
silence.
Is. And yes. Yes. We can practice restraint. That. We can practice restraint. Wise restraint.
Yeah,
maybe wise restraint comes out in the form of noble silence, or you know, maybe we don't have those thoughts of, boy, it's such a tough day to deal with XYZ on this project, right? We practice restraint. We notice that we're having these thoughts, and it is difficult to deal with unruly coworkers, tough clients, etc. But we're Dhamma practitioners. We have tools to orient ourselves. What can we do if we're really in a jam?
No, take
a deep breath. Take a deep breath.
Yeah. right? Nobody's going to attack you for taking a deep breath. You could sit there and breathe all day. Just walk away. Just practice.
And Kevin, at the end of the day, even though we're talking about wise associations, which sounds external to us, and then you gave an example of wise association that was internal, but at the end of the day, we can only control ourselves. Yes. So it's ourselves we should be focusing on. Yeah. So when we all will find ourselves in situations where, you know, we can say, mm-hmm. oh, family members who trigger us. No, mm-hmm. we're in a situation where we find ourselves triggered. But sorry for that little graphic that just showed up on the screen.
I like that.
Sorry. I saw one come up on the
John
Haspel thing too, as well. It's called a gesture. It's very difficult to get off the screen, believe me. Anyway, what I was saying is at the end of the day, it is John's wisdom, you know, the Buddha's wisdom in our head to come back to the breath, because it's only us that we can control. And so it really still is. I know, I saw it.
It really is
us.
Right.
That we can control. And it's coming back to our practice, our understanding of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path to inform us, and not get too caught up in the other people and things outside of us. We have to remind ourselves that it's about us. Yes. And I don't mean that in a conceitful way, in a way of identifying what's rising and then what's passing away. What's rising and what's passing away. My two cents.
Personal contribution to stress and suffering.
Yes. Exactly. Our work personal contribution.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you. I like what you said, Kevin. If I may say something else, thank you for the teaching. But I do have a question. When do you know that a mind is doing the fabrication? It's always the fabrication, and when is the? Because that would be kind of an association also with the fabrication of our mind. If it's a good fabrication, I think would be beneficial. But how do I know? How do I differentiate fabrication versus no fabrication?
This is not who I am.
Ooh. Yeah. Depending on how you look at it, anything that is stressful, anything that that makes stress arise in the mind is a fabrication. And, you know, that's one way to look at it. But when you're talking about fabrications in the Buddhist sense, that's a lot more restricted in meaning, and that specific thing that he uses in dependent origination is a very specific phenomena in the mind, and that would take an hour to get to the bottom of that one. But it arises directly out of ignorance, out of not knowing Four Noble Truths. A fabrication is really, because ignorance is the word ignorance really is just a description of where we are, how our mind operates, before we understand the Four Noble Truths. This is just kind of our primordial way of being, you know. The uninstructed person is just in ignorance. That's not a judgment. It is just a description of, you know, this again, it's the Buddhist shorthand of saying the uninstructed person, this is how they live. And then dependent origination describes
what goes on in the mind of the uninstructed person and why invariably the uninstructed person will be suffering and will be contributing to his own suffering second by second. And wow. The first step there is fabrications. And if you really want to get a quick lesson in what he meant by fabrications, then go to the Bahiya Sutta,
where
the Buddha instructs someone who had a deep, deep understanding of all three parts of not-self, suffering, and impermanence. He was just missing that little bit of understanding of the not-self. And what he says, in seeing, there is only the seen. In hearing, there is only the heard. And when you train this way, Bahia, there is no you there. That is the primordial fabrication, that when you experience something, you assume there is somebody there who does the experiencing. And you start to accumulate more and more importance. You start to aggregate more and more importance to that idea. So if you want to, you know, want to see where fabrications are, they're everywhere.
Wow. Thank you, Ron. That was great. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ron. Does anybody else like to share? Well, sure. Spin it around again.
I'm good.
All right. All right. Thank you all for a wonderful class. We will conclude with Karaniya Metta Sutta, as we always do. Find a relaxed meditative posture. This is the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what is done by those who are skilled in goodness and who know the path of peace. They are able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. They remain unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. They are peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. Not proud or demanding in nature, they do not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. They are always mindful that all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. They are always mindful not to deceive another or despise any being in any state. They abandon anger and ill will with ease, never wishing harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart, the wise disciple cherishes all living beings. They radiate kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, they maintain refined mindfulness. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, having completed the path, does not give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance of four noble truths. Thank you all. Mm-hmm.